This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Lost Symbol by Dan Brown. Read for you by Paul Michael. To live in the world without becoming aware of the meaning of the world is like wandering about in a great library without touching the books. The Secret Teachings of All Ages. Fact. In 1991, a document was locked in the safe of the director of the CIA. The document is still there today. Its cryptic text includes references to an ancient portal and an unknown location underground. The document also contains the phrase, "It's buried out there, somewhere." All organizations in this novel exist, including the Freemasons, the Invisible College, the Office of Security, the SMSC, and the Institute of Noetic Sciences. All rituals, science, artwork, and monuments in this novel are real. Prologue. House of the Temple, 8:33 p.m. The secret is how to die. Since the beginning of time, the secret had always been how to die. The 34-year-old initiate gazed down at the human skull cradled in his palms. The skull was hollow, like a bowl, filled with blood-red wine. "Drink it," he told himself. "You have nothing to fear." As was tradition, he had begun this journey adorned in the ritualistic garb of a medieval heretic being led to the gallows, his loose-fitting shirt gaping open to reveal his pale chest, his left pant leg rolled up to the knee, and his right sleeve rolled up to the elbow. Around his neck hung a heavy rope noose, a cable tow, as the brethren called it. Tonight, however, like the brethren bearing witness, he was dressed as a master. The assembly of brothers encircling him all were adorned in their full regalia of lambskin aprons, sashes, and white gloves. Around their necks hung ceremonial jewels that glistened like ghostly eyes in the muted light. Many of these men held powerful stations in life, and yet the initiate knew their worldly ranks meant nothing within these walls. Here, all men were equals, sworn brothers sharing a mystical bond. As he surveyed the daunting assembly, the initiate wondered who on the outside would ever believe that this collection of men would assemble in one place, much less this place. The room looked like a holy sanctuary from the ancient world. The truth, however, was stranger still. "I am just blocks away from the White House." This colossal edifice, located at 1733 16th Street, Northwest, in Washington, D.C., was a replica of a pre-Christian temple, the Temple of King Mausolus, the original mausoleum, a place to be taken after death. Outside the main entrance, two 17-ton sphinxes guarded the bronze doors. The interior was an ornate labyrinth of ritualistic chambers, halls, sealed vaults, libraries, and even a hollow wall that held the remains of two human bodies. The initiate had been told every room in this building held a secret, and yet he knew no room held deeper secrets than the gigantic chamber in which he was currently kneeling, with a skull cradled in his palms. The Temple Room. This room was a perfect square, and cavernous. The ceiling soared an astonishing 100 feet overhead, supported by monolithic columns of green granite. A tiered gallery of dark Russian walnut seats with hand-tooled pigskin encircled the room. A 33-foot-tall throne dominated the western wall, with a concealed pipe organ opposite it. The walls were a kaleidoscope of ancient symbols, Egyptian, Hebraic, astronomical, alchemical, and others yet unknown. Tonight, the temple room was lit by a series of precisely arranged candles. Their dim glow was aided only by a pale shaft of moonlight that filtered down through the expansive oculus in the ceiling and illuminated the room's most startling feature. An enormous altar, hewn from a solid block of polished Belgian black marble, situated dead center of the square chamber. "The secret is how to die," the initiate reminded himself.
"It is time," a voice whispered.
The initiate let his gaze climb the distinguished white-robed figure standing before him. The supreme, worshipful master. The man, in his late 50s, was an American icon, well-loved, robust, and incalculably wealthy. His once dark hair was turning silver, and his famous visage reflected a lifetime of power and a vigorous intellect. "Take the oath," the worshipful master said, his voice soft like falling snow. "Complete your journey." The initiate's journey, like all such journeys, had begun at the first degree. On that night, in a ritual similar to this one, the worshipful master had blindfolded him with a velvet hoodwink and pressed a ceremonial dagger to his bare chest, demanding, "Do you seriously declare, on your honor, uninfluenced by mercenary or any other unworthy motive, that you freely and voluntarily offer yourself as a candidate for the mysteries and privileges of this brotherhood?"
"I do,"
the initiate had lied. "Then let this be a sting to your consciousness," the master had warned him, "as well as instant death, should you ever betray the secrets to be imparted to you." At the time, the initiate had felt no fear. "They will never know my true purpose here." Tonight, however, he sensed a foreboding solemnity in the temple room, and his mind began replaying all the dire warnings he had been given on his journey, threats of terrible consequences if he ever shared the ancient secrets he was about to learn. Throat cut from ear to ear, tongue torn out by its roots, bowels taken out and burned, scattered to the four winds of heaven, heart plucked out and given to the beasts of the field. "Brother," the gray-eyed master said, placing his left hand on the initiate's shoulder, "take the final oath." Steeling himself for the last step of his journey, the initiate shifted his muscular frame and turned his attention back to the skull cradled in his palms. The crimson wine looked almost black in the dim candlelight. The chamber had fallen deathly silent, and he could feel all of the witnesses watching him, waiting for him to take his final oath and join their elite ranks. "Tonight," he thought, "something is taking place within these walls that has never before occurred in the history of this brotherhood, not once in centuries." He knew it would be the spark, and it would give him unfathomable power. Energized, he drew a breath and spoke aloud the same words that countless men had spoken before him in countries all over the world.
"May this wine I now drink become a deadly poison to me, should I ever knowingly or willfully violate my oath."
His words echoed in the hollow space. Then all was quiet. Steadying his hands, the initiate raised the skull to his mouth and felt his lips touch the dry bone. He closed his eyes and tipped the skull toward his mouth, drinking the wine in long, deep swallows. When the last drop was gone, he lowered the skull. For an instant, he thought he felt his lungs growing tight, and his heart began to pound wildly.
"My God, they know!"
Then, as quickly as it came, the feeling passed. A pleasant warmth began to stream through his body. The initiate exhaled, smiling inwardly, as he gazed up at the unsuspecting gray-eyed man who had foolishly admitted him into this brotherhood's most secretive ranks.
"Soon, you will lose everything you hold most dear."
Chapter 1. The Otis elevator climbing the south pillar of the Eiffel Tower was overflowing with tourists. Inside the cramped lift, an austere businessman in a pressed suit gazed down at the boy beside him. "You look pale, son. You should have stayed on the ground."
"I'm okay,"
the boy answered, struggling to control his anxiety.
"I'll get out on the next level."
"I can't breathe."
The man leaned closer. "I thought by now you would have gotten over this." He brushed the child's cheek affectionately. The boy felt ashamed to disappoint his father, but he could barely hear through the ringing in his ears.
"I can't breathe. I've got to get out of this box."
The elevator operator was saying something reassuring about the lift's articulated pistons and puddled iron construction. Far beneath them, the streets of Paris stretched out in all directions.
Almost there,
the boy told himself, craning his neck and looking up at the unloading platform.
Just hold on.
As the lift angled steeply toward the upper viewing deck, the shaft began to narrow, its massive struts contracting into a tight, vertical tunnel.
Dad, I don't think...
Suddenly, a staccato crack echoed overhead. The carriage jerked, swaying awkwardly to one side. Frayed cables began whipping around the carriage, thrashing like snakes. The boy reached out for his father.
Dad?
Their eyes locked for one terrifying second. Then, the bottom dropped out. Robert Langdon jolted upright in his soft leather seat, startled out of the semi-conscious daydream. He was sitting all alone in the enormous cabin of a Falcon 2000 EX corporate jet as it bounced its way through turbulence. In the background, the dual Pratt & Whitney engines hummed evenly.
Mr. Langdon?
The intercom crackled overhead.
We're on final approach.
Langdon sat up straight and slid his lecture notes back into his leather day bag. He'd been halfway through reviewing Masonic symbology when his mind had drifted. The daydream about his late father, Langdon suspected, had been stirred by this morning's unexpected invitation from Langdon's longtime mentor, Peter Solomon. The other man I never want to disappoint. The 58-year-old philanthropist, historian, and scientist had taken Langdon under his wing nearly 30 years ago, in many ways filling the void left by Langdon's father's death. Despite the man's influential family dynasty and massive wealth, Langdon had found humility and warmth in Solomon's soft gray eyes. Outside the window, the sun had set, but Langdon could still make out the slender silhouette of the world's largest obelisk, rising on the horizon like the spire of an ancient gnomon. The 555-foot marble-faced obelisk marked this nation's heart. All around the spire, the meticulous geometry of streets and monuments radiated outward. Even from the air, Washington, D.C., exuded an almost mystical power. Langdon loved this city, and as the jet touched down, he felt a rising excitement about what lay ahead. The jet taxied to a private terminal somewhere in the vast expanse of Dulles International Airport and came to a stop. Langdon gathered his things, thanked the pilots, and stepped out of the jet's luxurious interior onto the fold-out staircase. The cold January air felt liberating.
Breathe, Robert, he thought,
appreciating the wide-open spaces. A blanket of white fog crept across the runway, and Langdon had the sensation he was stepping into a marsh as he descended onto the misty tarmac.
Hello! Hello!
A sing-song British voice shouted from across the tarmac.
Professor Langdon?
Langdon looked up to see a middle-aged woman with a badge and clipboard hurrying toward him, waving happily as he approached. Curly blonde hair protruded from under a stylish knit wool hat.
Welcome to Washington, sir.
Langdon smiled. Thank you.
My name is Pam, from Passenger Services.
The woman spoke with an exuberance that was almost unsettling.
If you'll come with me, sir, your car is waiting.
Langdon followed her across the runway toward the signature terminal, which was surrounded by glistening private jets, a taxi stand for the rich and famous.
I hate to embarrass you, Professor,
the woman said, sounding sheepish.
But you are the Robert Langdon, who writes books about symbols and religion, aren't you?
Langdon hesitated, and then nodded.
I thought so,
she said, beaming.
My book group read your book about the sacred feminine and the church. What a delicious scandal that one caused. You do enjoy putting the fox in the hen house.
Langdon smiled. The scandal wasn't really my intention. The woman seemed to sense Langdon was not in the mood to discuss his work.
I'm sorry. Listen to me rattling on. I know you probably get tired of being recognized, but it's your own fault.
She playfully motioned to his clothing.
Your uniform gave you away.
My uniform? Langdon glanced down at his attire. He was wearing his usual charcoal turtleneck, Harris tweed jacket, khakis, and collegiate cordovan loafers. His standard attire for the classroom, lecture circuit, author photos, and social events. The woman laughed.
Those turtlenecks you wear are so dated. You'd look much sharper in a tie.
No chance, Langdon thought. Little nooses.
Neckties had been required 6 days a week when Langdon attended Phillips Exeter Academy, and despite the headmaster's romantic claims that the origin of the cravat went back to the silk fascalia worn by Roman orators to warm their vocal cords, Langdon knew that, etymologically, cravat actually derived from a ruthless band of Croat mercenaries who donned knotted neckerchiefs before they stormed into battle. To this day, this ancient battle garb was donned by modern office warriors, hoping to intimidate their enemies in daily boardroom battles.
"Thanks for the advice," Langdon said with a chuckle. "I'll consider a tie in the future."
Mercifully, a professional-looking man in a dark suit got out of a sleek Lincoln town car parked near the terminal and held up his finger.
"Mr. Langdon? I'm Charles with Beltway Limousine."
He opened the passenger door.
"Good evening, sir. Welcome to Washington."
Langdon tipped Pam for her hospitality and then climbed into the plush interior of the town car. The driver showed him the temperature controls, the bottled water, and the basket of hot muffins. Seconds later, Langdon was speeding away on a private access road.
"So this is how the other half lives."
As the driver gunned the car up Windsock Drive, he consulted his passenger manifest and placed a quick call.
"This is Beltway Limousine,"
the driver said with professional efficiency.
"I was asked to confirm once my passenger had landed."
He paused.
"Yes, sir. Your guest, Mr. Langdon, has arrived, and I will deliver him to the Capitol building by 7 p.m.
"You're welcome, sir." He hung up. Langdon had to smile. No stone left unturned. Peter Solomon's attention to detail was one of his most potent assets, allowing him to manage his substantial power with apparent ease. A few $1 billion in the bank doesn't hurt either. Langdon settled into the plush leather seat and closed his eyes as the noise of the airport faded behind him. The U.S. Capitol was a half hour away, and he appreciated the time alone to gather his thoughts. Everything had happened so quickly today that Langdon only now had begun to think in earnest about the incredible evening that lay ahead. Arriving under a veil of secrecy, Langdon thought, amused by the prospect. 10 miles from the Capitol building, a lone figure was eagerly preparing for Robert Langdon's arrival. Chapter 2. The one who called himself Moloch pressed the tip of the needle against his shaved head, sighing with pleasure as the sharp tool plunged in and out of his flesh. The soft hum of the electric device was addictive, as was the bite of the needle sliding deep into his dermis and depositing its dye.
"I am a masterpiece."
The goal of tattooing was never beauty. The goal was change. From the scarified Nubian priests of 2000 BC to the tattooed acolytes of the Cybele cult of ancient Rome to the Moko scars of the modern Maori, humans have tattooed themselves as a way of offering up their bodies in partial sacrifice, enduring the physical pain of embellishment and emerging changed beings. Despite the ominous admonitions of Leviticus 19:28, which forbade the marking of one's flesh, tattoos had become a rite of passage shared by millions of people in the modern age, everyone from clean-cut teenagers to hardcore drug users to suburban housewives. The act of tattooing one's skin was a transformative declaration of power, an announcement to the world. I am in control of my own flesh. The intoxicating feeling of control derived from physical transformation had addicted millions to flesh-altering practices. Cosmetic surgery, body piercing, bodybuilding, and steroids, even bulimia and transgendering. The human spirit craves mastery over its carnal shell. A single bell chimed on Moloch's grandfather clock, and he looked up. 6:30 p.m. Leaving his tools, he wrapped the Kiryu silk robe around his naked 6'3" body and strode down the hall. The air inside this sprawling mansion was heavy with the pungent fragrance of his skin dyes and smoke from the beeswax candles he used to sterilize his needles. The towering young man moved down the corridor past priceless Italian antiques, a Piranesi etching, a Savonarola chair, a silver Bugarini oil lamp. He glanced through a floor-to-ceiling window as he passed, admiring the classical skyline in the distance. The luminous dome of the U.S. Capitol glowed with solemn power against the dark winter sky.
This is where it is hidden, he thought. It is buried out there somewhere.
Few men knew it existed, and even fewer knew its awesome power, or the ingenious way in which it had been hidden. To this day it remained this country's greatest untold secret. Those few who did know the truth kept it hidden behind a veil of symbols, legends, and allegory.
Now they have opened their doors to me,
Malach thought. 3 weeks ago, in a dark ritual witnessed by America's most influential men, Malach had ascended to the 33rd degree, the highest echelon of the world's oldest surviving brotherhood. Despite Malach's new rank, the brethren had told him nothing. Nor will they, he knew. That was not how it worked. There were circles within circles. Brotherhoods within brotherhoods. Even if Malach waited years, he might never earn their ultimate trust. Fortunately, he did not need their trust to obtain their deepest secret.
My initiation served its purpose.
Now, energized by what lay ahead, he strode toward his bedroom. Throughout his entire home, audio speakers broadcast the eerie strains of a rare recording of a castrato singing the Lux Aeterna from the Verdi Requiem, a reminder of a previous life. Malach touched a remote control to bring on the thundering Dies Irae. Then, against a backdrop of crashing timpani and parallel fifths, he bounded up the marble staircase, his robe billowing as he ascended on sinewy legs. As he ran, his empty stomach growled in protest. For 2 days now, Malach had fasted, consuming only water, preparing his body in accordance with the ancient ways.
Your hunger will be satisfied by dawn, he reminded himself, along with your pain.
Malach entered his bedroom sanctuary with reverence, locking the door behind him. As he moved toward his dressing area, he paused, feeling himself drawn to the enormous gilded mirror. Unable to resist, he turned and faced his own reflection. Slowly, as if unwrapping a priceless gift, Malach opened his robe to unveil his naked form. The vision awed him.
I am a masterpiece.
His massive body was shaved and smooth. He lowered his gaze first to his feet, which were tattooed with the scales and talons of a hawk. Above that, his muscular legs were tattooed as carved pillars. His left leg spiraled, and his right vertically striated. Boaz and Jachin. His groin and abdomen formed a decorated archway, above which his powerful chest was emblazoned with the double-headed phoenix. Each head in profile, with its visible eye formed by one of Malach's nipples. His shoulders, neck, face, and shaved head were completely covered with an intricate tapestry of ancient symbols and sigils.
I am an artifact, an evolving icon.
One mortal man had seen Malach naked 18 hours earlier. The man had shouted in fear,
Good God, you're a demon!
If you perceive me as such,
Malach had replied, understanding, as had the ancients, that angels and demons were identical, interchangeable archetypes, all a matter of polarity. The guardian angel who conquered your enemy in battle was perceived by your enemy as a demon destroyer. Malach tipped his face down now and got an oblique view of the top of his head. There, within the crown-like halo, shone a small circle of pale, untattooed flesh. This carefully guarded canvas was Malach's only remaining piece of virgin skin. The sacred space had waited patiently, and tonight it would be filled. Although Malach did not yet possess what he required to complete his masterpiece, he knew the moment was fast approaching. Exhilarated by his reflection, he could already feel his power growing. He closed his robe and walked to the window, again gazing out at the mystical city before him.
It is buried out there, somewhere.
Refocusing on the task at hand, Malach went to his dressing table and carefully applied a base of concealer makeup to his face, scalp, and neck until his tattoos had disappeared. Then he donned the special set of clothing and other items he had meticulously prepared for this evening. When he finished, he checked himself in the mirror. Satisfied, he ran a soft palm across his smooth scalp and smiled.
It is out there, he thought, and tonight one man will help me find it.
As Malak exited his home, he prepared himself for the event that would soon shake the U.S. Capitol building. He had gone to enormous lengths to arrange all the pieces for tonight. And now, at last, his final pawn had entered the game. Chapter 3
Robert Langdon was busy reviewing his note cards when the hum of the town car's tires changed pitch on the road beneath him. Langdon glanced up, surprised to see where they were. Memorial Bridge already? He put down his notes and gazed out at the calm waters of the Potomac passing beneath him. A heavy mist hovered on the surface. Aptly named, Foggy Bottom had always seemed a peculiar site on which to build the nation's capital. Of all the places in the New World, the forefathers had chosen a soggy riverside marsh on which to lay the cornerstone of their utopian society. Langdon gazed left, across the tidal basin, toward the gracefully rounded silhouette of the Jefferson Memorial, America's Pantheon, as many called it. Directly in front of the car, the Lincoln Memorial rose with rigid austerity, its orthogonal lines reminiscent of Athens' ancient Parthenon. But it was farther away that Langdon saw the city's centerpiece, the same spire he had seen from the air. Its architectural inspiration was far, far older than the Romans or the Greeks. America's Egyptian obelisk. The monolithic spire of the Washington Monument loomed dead ahead, illuminated against the sky like the majestic mast of a ship. From Langdon's oblique angle, the obelisk appeared ungrounded tonight, swaying against the dreary sky, as if on an unsteady sea. Langdon felt similarly ungrounded. His visit to Washington had been utterly unexpected. I woke up this morning anticipating a quiet Sunday at home, and now I'm a few minutes away from the U.S. Capitol. This morning at 4:45, Langdon had plunged into dead calm water, beginning his day as he always did, swimming 50 laps in the deserted Harvard pool. His physique was not quite what it had been in his college days as a water polo All-American, but he was still lean and toned, respectable for a man in his 40s. The only difference now was the amount of effort it took Langdon to keep it that way. When Langdon arrived home around 6, he began his morning ritual of hand-grinding Sumatra coffee beans and savoring the exotic scent that filled his kitchen. This morning, however, he was surprised to see the blinking red light on his voicemail display. Who calls at 6 a.m. on a Sunday? He pressed the button and listened to the message.
Good morning, Professor Langdon. I'm terribly sorry for this early morning call.
The polite voice was noticeably hesitant, with a hint of a southern accent.
My name is Anthony Gelbart, and I'm Peter Solomon's executive assistant. Mr. Solomon told me you're an early riser. He's been trying to reach you this morning on short notice. As soon as you receive this message, would you be so kind as to call Peter directly? You probably have his new private line, but if not, it's 202-329-5746.
Langdon felt a sudden concern for his old friend. Peter Solomon was impeccably well-bred and courteous, and certainly not the kind of man to call at daybreak on a Sunday unless something was very wrong. Langdon left his coffee half-made and hurried toward his study to return the call. I hope he's okay. Peter Solomon had been a friend, mentor, and, although only 12 years Langdon's senior, a father figure to him ever since their first meeting at Princeton University. As a sophomore, Langdon had been required to attend an evening guest lecture by the well-known young historian and philanthropist. Solomon had spoken with a contagious passion, presenting a dazzling vision of semiotics and archetypal history that had sparked in Langdon what would later become his lifelong passion for symbols. It was not Peter Solomon's brilliance, however, but the humility in his gentle gray eyes that had given Langdon the courage to write him a thank you letter. The young sophomore had never dreamed that Peter Solomon, one of America's wealthiest and most intriguing young intellectuals, would ever write back. But Solomon did. And it had been the beginning of a truly gratifying friendship. A prominent academic whose quiet manner belied his powerful heritage
Peter Solomon came from the ultra-wealthy Solomon family, whose names appeared on buildings and universities all over the nation. Like the Rothschilds in Europe, the surname Solomon had always carried the mystique of American royalty and success. Peter had inherited the mantle at a young age after the death of his father, and now, at 58, he had held numerous positions of power in his life. He currently served as the head of the Smithsonian Institution. Langdon occasionally ribbed Peter that the lone tarnish on his sterling pedigree was his diploma from a second-rate university, Yale. Now, as Langdon entered his study, he was surprised to see that he had received a fax from Peter as well. Peter Solomon, Office of the Secretary, the Smithsonian Institution. Good morning, Robert. I need to speak with you at once. Please call me this morning, as soon as you can, at 202-329-5746. Peter. Langdon immediately dialed the number, sitting down at his hand-carved oak desk to wait as the call went through.
Office of Peter Solomon, the familiar voice of the assistant answered. This is Anthony. May I help you?
Hello, this is Robert Langdon. You left me a message earlier.
Yes, Professor Langdon.
The young man sounded relieved.
Thank you for calling back so quickly. Mr. Solomon is eager to speak to you. Let me tell him you're on the line. May I put you on hold?
Of course. As Langdon waited for Solomon to get on the line, he gazed down at Peter's name atop the Smithsonian letterhead and had to smile. Not many slackers in the Solomon clan. Peter's ancestral tree burgeoned with the names of wealthy business magnates, influential politicians, and a number of distinguished scientists. Some even fellows of London's Royal Society. Solomon's only living family member, his younger sister Catherine, had apparently inherited the science gene, because she was now a leading figure in a new cutting-edge discipline called noetic science. All Greek to me, Langdon thought, amused to recall Catherine's unsuccessful attempt to explain noetic science to him at a party at her brother's home last year. Langdon had listened carefully and then replied, "Sounds more like magic than science." Catherine winked playfully.
They're closer than you think, Robert.
Now Solomon's assistant returned to the phone.
I'm sorry, Mr. Solomon is trying to get off a conference call. Things are a little chaotic here this morning.
That's not a problem. I can easily call back.
Actually, he asked me to fill you in on his reason for contacting you, if you don't mind.
Of course not. The assistant inhaled deeply.
As you probably know, Professor, every year here in Washington, the board of the Smithsonian hosts a private gala to thank our most generous supporters. Many of the country's cultural elite attend.
Langdon knew his own bank account had too few zeros to qualify him as culturally elite, but he wondered if maybe Solomon was going to invite him to attend nonetheless.
This year, as is customary, the assistant continued, the dinner will be preceded by a keynote address. We've been lucky enough to secure the National Statuary Hall for that speech.
The best room in all of D.C., Langdon thought, recalling a political lecture he had once attended in the dramatic semicircular hall. It was hard to forget 500 folding chairs splayed in a perfect arc, surrounded by 38 life-size statues, in a room that had once served as the nation's original House of Representatives chamber.
The problem is this,
the man said.
Our speaker has fallen ill and has just informed us she will be unable to give the address.
He paused awkwardly.
This means we are desperate for a replacement speaker, and Mr. Solomon is hoping you would consider filling in.
Langdon did a double take. Me? This was not at all what he had expected. I'm sure Peter could find a far better substitute.
You're Mr. Solomon's first choice, Professor, and you're being much too modest. The institution's guests would be thrilled to hear from you, and Mr. Solomon thought you could give the same lecture you gave on Bookspan TV a few years back. That way you wouldn't have to prepare a thing. He said your talk involved symbolism in the architecture of our nation's capital. It sounds absolutely perfect for the venue.
Langdon was not so sure. If I recall, that lecture had more to do with the Masonic history of the building than—
Exactly. As you know, Mr. Solomon is a Mason, as are many of his professional friends who will be in attendance. I'm sure they would love to hear you speak on the topic.
I admit it would be easy. Langdon had kept the lecture notes from every talk he'd ever given. I suppose I could consider it. What date is the event? The assistant cleared his throat, sounding suddenly uncomfortable.
Well, actually, sir, it's tonight.
Langdon laughed out loud. Tonight?
That's why it's so hectic here this morning. The Smithsonian is in a deeply embarrassing predicament.
The assistant spoke more hurriedly now.
Mrs. Solomon is ready to send a private jet to Boston for you. The flight is only an hour, and you would be back home before midnight. You're familiar with the private air terminal at Boston's Logan Airport?
I am, Langdon admitted reluctantly. No wonder Peter always gets his way.
Wonderful. Would you be willing to meet the jet there at, say, 5 o'clock?
You haven't left me much choice, have you? Langdon chuckled.
I just want to make Mr. Solomon happy, sir.
Peter has that effect on people. Langdon considered it a long moment, seeing no way out. All right. Tell him I can do it.
Outstanding,
the assistant exclaimed, sounding deeply relieved. He gave Langdon the jet's tail number and various other information. When Langdon finally hung up, he wondered if Peter Solomon had ever been told no. Returning to his coffee preparation, Langdon scooped some additional beans into the grinder. A little extra caffeine this morning, he thought. It's going to be a long day. Chapter 4
The U.S. Capitol building stands regally at the eastern end of the National Mall, on a raised plateau that city designer Pierre L'Enfant described as a pedestal waiting for a monument. The Capitol's massive footprint measures more than 750 feet in length and 350 feet deep. Housing more than 16 acres of floor space, it contains an astonishing 541 rooms. The neoclassical architecture is meticulously designed to echo the grandeur of ancient Rome, whose ideals were the inspiration for America's founders in establishing the laws and culture of the new republic. The new security checkpoint for tourists entering the Capitol building is located deep within the recently completed subterranean visitor center, beneath a magnificent glass skylight that frames the Capitol dome. Newly hired security guard Alfonso Nunez carefully studied the male visitor now approaching his checkpoint. The man had a shaved head and had been lingering in the lobby, completing a phone call before entering the building. His right arm was in a sling, and he moved with a slight limp. He was wearing a tattered Army-Navy surplus coat, which, combined with his shaved head, made Nunez guess military. Those who had served in the U.S. Armed Forces were among the most common visitors to Washington.
"Good evening, sir," Nunez said, following the security protocol of verbally engaging any male visitor who entered alone.
"Hello?"
the visitor said, glancing around at the nearly deserted entry.
"Quiet night."
"NFC playoffs," Nunez replied. "Everyone's watching the Redskins tonight." Nunez wished he were, too, but this was his first month on the job, and he'd drawn the short straw.
"Metal objects in the dish, please."
As the visitor fumbled to empty the pockets of his long coat with his one working hand, Nunez watched him carefully. Human instinct made special allowances for the injured and handicapped, but it was an instinct Nunez had been trained to override. Nunez waited while the visitor removed from his pockets the usual assortment of loose change, keys, and a couple of cell phones.
"Sprain?" Nunez asked, eyeing the man's injured hand, which appeared to be wrapped in a series of thick ace bandages. The bald man nodded.
"Slipped on the ice, a week ago. Still hurts like hell."
"Sorry to hear that. Walk through, please."
The visitor limped through the detector, and the machine buzzed in protest. The visitor frowned.
"I was afraid of that. I'm wearing a ring under these bandages. My finger was too swollen to get it off, so the doctors wrapped right over it."
"No problem," Nunez said. "I'll use the wand."
Nunez ran the metal detection wand over the visitor's wrapped hand. As expected, the only metal he detected was a large lump on the man's injured ring finger. Nunez took his time rubbing the metal detector over every inch of the man's sling and finger. He knew his supervisor was probably monitoring him on the closed circuit in the building's security center, and Nunez needed this job. Always better to be cautious. He carefully slid the wand up inside the man's sling. The visitor winced in pain.
"Sorry." "It's okay,"
the man said.
"You can't be too careful these days."
"Ain't that the truth?" Nunez liked this guy. Strangely, that counted for a lot around here. Human instinct was America's first line of defense against terrorism. It was a proven fact that human intuition was a more accurate detector of danger than all the electronic gear in the world. The gift of fear, as one of their security reference books termed it. In this case, Nunez's instincts sensed nothing that caused him any fear. The only oddity that he noticed, now that they were standing so close, was that this tough-looking guy appeared to have used some kind of self-tanner or concealer makeup on his face. Whatever. Everyone hates to be pale in the winter. You're fine, Nunez said, completing his sweep and stowing the wand.
Thanks.
The man started collecting his belongings from the tray. As he did, Nunez noticed that the two fingers protruding from his bandage each bore a tattoo. The tip of his index finger bore the image of a crown, and the tip of his thumb bore that of a star. Seems everyone has tattoos these days, Nunez thought, although the pads of his fingertips seemed like painful spots to get them.
Those tats hurt?
The man glanced down at his fingertips and chuckled.
Less than you might think.
Lucky, Nunez said. Mine hurt a lot. I got a mermaid on my back when I was in boot camp.
A mermaid?
The bald man chuckled.
Yeah, he said, feeling sheepish. The mistakes we make in our youth.
I hear you, the bald man said. I made a big mistake in my youth, too.
Now I wake up with her every morning.
They both laughed as the man headed off. Child's play, Malak thought, as he moved past Nunez and up the escalator toward the Capitol building. The entry had been easier than anticipated. Malak's slouching posture and padded belly had hidden his true physique, while the makeup on his face and hands had hidden the tattoos that covered his body. The true genius, however, was the sling, which disguised the potent object Malak was transporting into the building. A gift for the one man on earth who can help me obtain what I seek. Chapter 5. The world's largest and most technologically advanced museum is also one of the world's best-kept secrets. It houses more pieces than the Hermitage, the Vatican Museum, and the New York Metropolitan combined. Yet despite its magnificent collection, few members of the public are ever invited inside its heavily guarded walls. Located at 4210 Silver Hill Road, just outside of Washington, D.C., the museum is a massive zigzag-shaped edifice constructed of 5 interconnected pods, each pod larger than a football field. The building's bluish metal exterior barely hints at the strangeness within. A 600,000-square-foot alien world that contains a dead zone, a wet pod, and more than 12 miles of storage cabinets. Tonight, scientist Catherine Solomon was feeling unsettled as she drove her white Volvo up to the building's main security gate. The guard smiled. "Not a football fan, Ms. Solomon?" He lowered the volume on the Redskins' playoff pregame show. Catherine forced a tense smile.
"It's Sunday night."
"Oh, that's right. Your meeting."
"Is he here yet?"
she asked anxiously. He glanced down at his paperwork. "I don't see him on the log."
"I'm early."
Catherine gave a friendly wave and continued up the winding access road to her usual parking spot at the bottom of the small, two-tiered lot. She began collecting her things and gave herself a quick check in the rearview mirror, more out of force of habit than actual vanity. Catherine Solomon had been blessed with the resilient Mediterranean skin of her ancestry, and even at 50 years old she had a smooth, olive complexion. She used almost no makeup and wore her thick black hair unstyled and down. Like her older brother Peter, she had gray eyes and a slender, patrician elegance. "You two might as well be twins," people often told them. Their father had succumbed to cancer when Catherine was only 7, and she had little memory of him. Her brother, 8 years Catherine's senior and only 15 when their father died, had begun his journey toward becoming the Solomon Patriarch much sooner than anyone had ever dreamed. As expected, though, Peter had grown into the role with the dignity and strength befitting their family name. To this day, he still watched over Catherine as though they were just kids. Despite her brother's occasional prodding and no shortage of suitors, Catherine had never married. Science had become her life partner, and her work had proven more fulfilling and exciting than any man could ever hope to be. Catherine had no regrets. Her field of choice, noetic science, had been virtually unknown when she first heard of it. But in recent years, it had started opening new doors of understanding into the power of the human mind.
"Our untapped potential is truly shocking."
Catherine's 2 books on noetics had established her as a leader in this obscure field, but her most recent discoveries, when published, promised to make noetic science a topic of mainstream conversation around the world. Tonight, however, science was the last thing on her mind. Earlier in the day, she had received some truly upsetting information relating to her brother.
I still can't believe it's true.
She'd thought of nothing else all afternoon. A pattering of light rain drummed on her windshield, and Catherine quickly gathered her things to get inside. She was about to step out of her car when her cell phone rang. She checked the caller ID and inhaled deeply. Then she tucked her hair behind her ears and settled in to take the call. 6 miles away, Malach was moving through the corridors of the U.S. Capitol building with a cell phone pressed to his ear. He waited patiently as the line rang. Finally, a woman's voice answered.
Yes? We need to meet again, Malach said.
There was a long pause.
Is everything all right?
I have new information, Malach said.
Tell me.
Malach took a deep breath.
That which your brother believes is hidden in D.C.
Yes?
It can be found.
Catherine Solomon sounded stunned.
You're telling me it is real?
Malach smiled to himself.
Sometimes a legend that endures for centuries endures for a reason.
Chapter 6. Is this as close as you can get? Robert Langdon felt a sudden wave of anxiety as his driver parked on First Street, a good quarter mile from the Capitol building. Afraid so, the driver said. Homeland Security. No vehicles near landmark buildings anymore. I'm sorry, sir. Langdon checked his watch, startled to see it was already 6:50. A construction zone around the National Mall had slowed them down, and his lecture was to begin in 10 minutes. Weather's turning, the driver said, hopping out and opening Langdon's door for him. You'll want to hurry. Langdon reached for his wallet to tip the driver, but the man waved him off. Your host already added a very generous tip to the charge. Typical Peter, Langdon thought, gathering his things. Okay, thanks for the ride. The first few raindrops began to fall as Langdon reached the top of the gracefully arched concourse that descended to the new underground visitor's entrance. The Capitol Visitor Center had been a costly and controversial project. Described as an underground city to rival parts of Disney World, this subterranean space reportedly provided over 500,000 square feet of space for exhibits, restaurants, and meeting halls. Langdon had been looking forward to seeing it, although he hadn't anticipated quite this long a walk. The skies were threatening to open at any moment, and he broke into a jog, his loafers offering almost no traction on the wet cement. I dressed for a lecture, not a 400-yard downhill dash through the rain. When he arrived at the bottom, he was breathless and panting. Langdon pushed through the revolving door, taking a moment in the foyer to catch his breath and brush off the rain. As he did, he raised his eyes to the newly completed space before him. Okay, I'm impressed. The Capitol Visitor Center was not at all what he had expected. Because the space was underground, Langdon had been apprehensive about passing through it. A childhood accident had left him stranded at the bottom of a deep well overnight, and Langdon now lived with an almost crippling aversion to enclosed spaces. But this underground space was airy somehow. Light. Spacious. The ceiling was a vast expanse of glass with a series of dramatic light fixtures that threw a muted glow across the pearl-colored interior finishes. Normally, Langdon would have taken a full hour in here to admire the architecture, but with 5 minutes until showtime, he put his head down and dashed through the main hall toward the security checkpoint and escalators. Relax, he told himself. Peter knows you're on your way. The event won't start without you. At the security point, a young Hispanic guard chatted with him while Langdon emptied his pockets and removed his vintage watch. Mickey Mouse? The guard said, sounding mildly amused. Langdon nodded, accustomed to the comments. The collector's edition Mickey Mouse watch had been a gift from his parents on his 9th birthday. I wear it to remind me to slow down and take life less seriously.
I don't think it's working, the guard said with a smile. You look like you're in a serious hurry.
Langdon smiled and put his day bag through the X-ray machine. Which way to the statuary hall? The guard motioned toward the escalators.
You'll see the signs.
Thanks. Langdon grabbed his bag off the conveyor and hurried on. As the escalator ascended, Langdon took a deep breath and tried to gather his thoughts. He gazed up through the rain-speckled glass ceiling at the mountainous form of the illuminated Capitol Dome overhead. It was an astonishing building. High atop her roof, almost 300 feet in the air, the Statue of Freedom peered out into the misty darkness like a ghostly sentinel. Langdon always found it ironic that the workers who hoisted each piece of the 19.5-foot bronze statue to her perch were slaves, a capital secret that seldom made the syllabi of high school history classes. This entire building, in fact, was a treasure trove of bizarre arcana that included a killer bathtub responsible for the pneumonic murder of Vice President Henry Wilson, a staircase with a permanent bloodstain over which an inordinate number of guests seemed to trip, and a sealed basement chamber in which workers in 1930 discovered General John Alexander Logan's long-deceased stuffed horse. No legends were as enduring, however, as the claims of 13 different ghosts that haunted this building. The spirit of city designer Pierre L'Enfant frequently was reported wandering the halls seeking payment of his bill, now 200 years overdue. The ghost of a worker who fell from the Capitol Dome during construction was seen wandering the corridors with a tray of tools. And, of course, the most famous apparition of all, reported numerous times in the Capitol basement, an ephemeral black cat that prowled the substructure's eerie maze of narrow passageways and cubicles. Langdon stepped off the escalator and again checked his watch. 3 minutes. He hurried down the wide corridor, following the signs toward the statuary hall and rehearsing his opening remarks in his head. Langdon had to admit that Peter's assistant had been correct. This lecture topic would be a perfect match for an event hosted in Washington, D.C. by a prominent Mason. It was no secret that D.C. had a rich Masonic history. The cornerstone of this very building had been laid in a full Masonic ritual by George Washington himself. This city had been conceived and designed by master Masons, George Washington, Ben Franklin, and Pierre L'Enfant, powerful minds who adorned their new capital with Masonic symbolism, architecture, and art. Of course, people see in those symbols all kinds of crazy ideas. Many conspiracy theorists claimed the Masonic forefathers had concealed powerful secrets throughout Washington, along with symbolic messages hidden in the city's layout of streets. Langdon never paid any attention. Misinformation about the Masons was so commonplace that even educated Harvard students seemed to have surprisingly warped conceptions about the Brotherhood. Last year, a freshman had rushed wild-eyed into Langdon's classroom with a printout from the web. It was a street map of D.C., on which certain streets had been highlighted to form various shapes. Satanic pentacles, a Masonic compass and square, the head of Baphomet, proof, apparently, that the Masons who designed Washington, D.C., were involved in some kind of dark, mystical conspiracy. "Fun," Langdon said, "but hardly convincing. If you draw enough intersecting lines on a map, you're bound to find all kinds of shapes."
"But this can't be coincidence," the kid exclaimed.
Langdon patiently showed the student the same exact shapes could be formed on a street map of Detroit. The kid seemed sorely disappointed.
"Don't be disheartened," Langdon said. "Washington does have some incredible secrets, just none on this street map."
The young man perked up.
"Secrets? Like what?"
"Every spring I teach a course called Occult Symbols. I talk a lot about D.C. You should take the course."
"Occult Symbols?"
The freshman looked excited again.
"So there are devil symbols in D.C.?"
Langdon smiled. "Sorry, but the word occult, despite conjuring images of devil worship, actually means hidden or obscured. In times of religious oppression, knowledge that was counter-doctrinal had to be kept hidden or occult, and because the church felt threatened by this, they redefined anything occult as evil, and the prejudice survived."
"Oh," the kid slumped.
Nonetheless, that spring, Langdon spotted the freshman seated in the front row as 500 students bustled into Harvard's Sanders Theater, a hollow old lecture hall with creaking wooden benches.
"Good morning, everybody,"
Langdon shouted from the expansive stage. He turned on a slide projector, and an image materialized behind him.
"As you're getting settled, how many of you recognize the building in this picture?"
"U.S. Capitol,"
dozens of voices called out in unison.
"Washington, D.C.
"Yes, there are 9 million pounds of ironwork in that dome, an unparalleled feat of architectural ingenuity,
for the 1850s. Awesome, somebody shouted. Langdon rolled his eyes, wishing somebody would ban that word. Okay, and how many of you have ever been to Washington? A scattering of hands went up. So few? Langdon feigned surprise. And how many of you have been to Rome, Paris, Madrid, or London? Almost all the hands in the room went up. As usual. One of the rites of passage for American college kids was a summer with a Eurorail ticket before the harsh reality of real life set in. It appears many more of you have visited Europe than have visited your own capital. Why do you think that is? No drinking age in Europe, someone in back shouted. Langdon smiled, as if the drinking age here stops any of you. Everyone laughed. It was the first day of school, and the students were taking longer than usual to get settled, shifting and creaking in their wooden pews. Langdon loved teaching in this hall because he always knew how engaged the students were simply by listening to how much they fidgeted in their pews. Seriously, Langdon said, Washington, D.C. has some of the world's finest architecture, art, and symbolism. Why would you go overseas before visiting your own capital? Ancient stuff is cooler, someone said. And by ancient stuff, Langdon clarified, I assume you mean castles, crypts, temples, that sort of thing? Their heads nodded in unison. Okay. Now what if I told you that Washington, D.C. has every one of those things? Castles, crypts, pyramids, temples? It's all there. The creaking diminished. My friends, Langdon said, lowering his voice and moving to the front of the stage, in the next hour you will discover that our nation is overflowing with secrets and hidden history. And exactly as in Europe, all of the best secrets are hidden in plain view. The wooden pews fell dead silent. Gotcha. Langdon dimmed the lights and called up his second slide. Who can tell me what George Washington is doing here? The slide was a famous mural depicting George Washington dressed in full Masonic regalia standing before an odd-looking contraption, a giant wooden tripod that supported a rope and pulley system from which was suspended a massive block of stone. A group of well-dressed onlookers stood around him. Lifting that big block of stone? Someone ventured. Langdon said nothing, preferring that a student make the correction if possible. Actually, another student offered, I think Washington is lowering the rock. He's wearing a Masonic costume. I've seen pictures of Masons laying cornerstones before. The ceremony always uses that tripod thing to lower the first stone. Excellent, Langdon said. The mural portrays the father of our country using a tripod and pulley to lay the cornerstone of our Capitol building on September 18, 1793, between the hours of 11:15 and 12:30. Langdon paused, scanning the class. Can anyone tell me the significance of that date and time? Silence. What if I told you that precise moment was chosen by three famous Masons, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Pierre L'Enfant, the primary architect for D.C.? More silence. Quite simply, the cornerstone was set at that date and time because, among other things, the auspicious Caput Draconis was in Virgo. Everyone exchanged odd looks. Hold on, someone said. You mean, like, astrology? Exactly, although a different astrology than we know today. A hand went up. You mean our founding fathers believed in astrology? Langdon grinned. Big time. What would you say if I told you the city of Washington, D.C. has more astrological signs in its architecture than any other city in the world? Zodiacs, star charts, cornerstones laid at precise astrological dates and times? More than half of the framers of our Constitution were Masons, men who strongly believed that the stars and fate were intertwined, men who paid close attention to the layout of the heavens as they structured their new world. But that whole thing about the Capitol cornerstone being laid while Caput Draconis was in Virgo? Who cares? Can't that just be coincidence? An impressive coincidence, considering that the cornerstones of the three structures that make up Federal Triangle, the Capitol, the White House, the Washington Monument, were all laid in different years but were carefully timed to occur under this exact same astrological condition. Langdon's gaze was met by a room full of wide eyes. A number of heads dipped down as students began taking notes. A hand in back went up. Why did they do that? Langdon chuckled. The answer to that is an entire semester's worth of material. If you're curious, you should take my mysticism course. Frankly, I don't think you guys are emotionally prepared to hear the answer. What? the person shouted. Try us.
Langdon made a show of considering it, and then shook his head, toying with them. Sorry, I can't do that. Some of you are only freshmen. I'm afraid it might blow your minds.